Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks? How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. My guest today is John Mulaney, the young stand-up comic, a young man. You know, I've gotten some feedback on occasion when I talk to the younger comedians that maybe I'm a little hard on them. Or maybe it comes off as sour grapes of some kind. But I don't think I did that with John. But maybe I'm guilty of that, I guess. You know, show business is tough, man. It's tough. And if you're lucky or unlucky enough to not see any way out of it, maybe something will pan out for you. Things eventually did. But I can't tell you how many times in my life where I thought that everything was going to happen, that this was it. This was it. If I really think about the amount of heartbreak and disappointment that one encounters in pursuing one's dream or even a career, everyone understands that, how much we have to sort of reconcile that and absorb it and process it if possible, hopefully without getting bitter or cynical, which seems almost a ridiculous task to open your heart so much that any sort of leveling will just become a learning experience. It sort of has to be. You don't have any real choice, do you? But I don't, like, now looking back at it as a 51-year-old, I don't know that I learned any lessons necessarily, other than when I look back at all the failures and disappointments and the ways that I fucked up, I just sort of think, like, well, I lived through it. But there are some things I don't know if they're any better at all. Because there's some, like, there are younger people. Now, I'm going to talk to John Mulaney today. He has a big opportunity. His show is in a little bit of trouble. But the truth of the matter is, you know, he's going to go on with his life one way or the other. You know, life is full of heartbreaks and disappointments. It just gets to a point where it's like, I don't want any more. Can I not have them anymore? Wow. Oh, my God. I watched that movie Whiplash last night. And it has something to do, like, there's something about that, you know, really being humbled and beaten enough to finally grow the fuck up. And I know some of you are on to me already with this stuff. I don't know that if I've fully done that. I don't, like, you know, I know I'm a 51-year-old man, but, you know, emotionally I don't seem to be that. And I don't know what I expect out of people, but, like, all of a sudden, all this shit is becoming very clear. Like, you know, I got all this stuff going on, but here there's this one flaw, dude. There's this one flaw that keeps you spinning in the same place, keeps you in pain, keeps people who are with you in pain, on and off, pain relief, you know, the drama cycle. God damn it. I don't know, maybe I'm just having a bad day. Maybe I think I wasted my youth somehow. I don't look back and think, like, what about all them good times? Just panic. Just a parade of panic in different outfits with different ideas about what was going on. It wasn't panic. It was passion. Angry panic. And a lot of, like, come on, look at me. What about me? Where's mine? How come I can't have it? When am I going to? What's the story? Why does that guy get to? God damn it. What about me? What do you do? I do me. I'm doing it right now. You don't like it? Come on. Fuck you. Fuck you. Reckon with me. I don't know if that's everyone's idea of entertainment. Well, you're bullshit. Fuck you. You're not entertained? Are you compelled? Are you engaged? You fuck? Yeah, I got this meeting's over. Yeah, fine. I don't give a shit. That was it. That was my early years. I was definitely not as together as John Mulaney, who we're going to talk to right now.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Now. John Mulaney's in the garage. I don't even intro people. I don't even know why I did that. But I just did it for my own sake.
Just like a clapboard.
We're gonna land. We're gonna get grounded.
Yeah.
Right now.
We're gonna set it up.
How you feeling? Were you nervous coming up here?
Nervous? Yeah, I'm nervous before everything. But I was not extra nervous.
It's You're not nice freaking out? You. It's nice to see you too.
Yeah, a little bit, sure.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. How you been?
I'm all right. You know, I'm trying to, you know, work. I'm very busy.
Yes, you are.
You moved out here, though?
Pretty much, yeah. I got married in July, and my wife and I have been renting a place.
You got married in July?
Yeah.
I'm happy to hear it for you.
Oh, thank you.
What does she do?
She is was a makeup artist for years and is now a style writer, has a new book out called The Daily Face.
Plugging his wife's book, folks.
Right out of the gate, plugging
right
it.
Right out of the gate. Make sure she's happy.
Anna, I plugged it right out of the gate.
Yeah.
He
got that taken care of, Anna.
Yeah.
July, August, September, October, November. So it's been like 4 months.
I guess so.
And you dated for how long before?
4.5 years.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're like right on track. You're right on track for everything.
Everything was done in the proper way.
That's right. Really? Courting?
There was courting. We knew each other for a while. And then we were like friends who wanted to date for many months and then started dating.
What, so you were like, oh, we gotta, I feel it. Do you feel it?
Well, I didn't think, the pattern of my life was liking a girl and she didn't like me back. But,
really?
But we'd be good friends. So I thought, okay, this is another one of those, which I was very comfortable in. I was very, very comfortable in that situation.
Yeah.
And then she wrote me an email saying she liked me, but I thought the email said, sometimes you flirt with me and it's uncomfortable. Like, there were two ways to read this email.
It was that difficult to read, huh? She said she liked you, and you somehow read that as, like, please stop bothering me.
I think she said something to the effect, without having the exact language, something to the effect of, you know, we're such good friends, but sometimes we seem like we're flirting, and that seems like it's a different level. And I thought she meant, like, stop flirting with me right now. Yeah.
Right, but she meant...
she meant I like you.
Are we taking it up a notch?
Yeah, and I was mad. I was in the middle of an all-nighter at SNL, and it was like 1 a.m. when I got the email. And I didn't write back. And so she thought it was like a rejection. Or not a rejection. She just thought, like, what the hell's wrong with this guy that he didn't write me back after that?
So you're fundamentally an insecure fella.
Of course.
I know, I'm just saying this out loud.
Yeah.
Why is that? You seem, you're an attractive man.
Thank you. So are you.
Talented fella.
So are you. Thank you.
You're young. You got good hair.
I have newscaster hair, and I had a good orthodontist in the 90s, one of Chicago's best orthodontists.
Did you? Is that what you were told?
Yeah, he was a good north side of Chicago orthodontist.
What does that mean, north side? You grew up on the north side?
Yeah, like Lincoln Park, so not far from Second City and Zanies to place it in a comedy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why I remember Zanies as being almost in a suburb. Kinda.
Well, there's three Zanies. You know, there's Naperville, then St. Charles, Illinois, and then one on Well Street.
Yeah, the one on Well Street, in my mind, was sort of like, I remember there was an apartment building around there. And
yeah.
It didn't feel like I was in Chicago.
Oh, well, that's
been there
10
in
minutes
years.
From downtown. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that you grew up around there.
Yeah.
You grew up with a large family?
Yeah, I'm the third of four kids.
How many boys?
Two sons. I'm the second son, and then two daughters.
And the daughters are old?
No, I have a little sister who just turned 27.
Yeah.
Is that right? I'm not going to do the math, Claire. The oldest of us is Carolyn, is my older sister.
And she's how old?
She is 1970 and 8, so she is 35 or 36.
Wow. I don't know why I'm saying that. You're like,
these are ordinary facts.
They're ordinary facts, but you're a young person.
I am 32 now, yeah.
Is 32 years old.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've done an amazing amount of stuff.
It's been a nice few years.
Okay, so let's get down to brass tacks here. So you grew up, there's a lot of kids, Catholics.
Yeah, Irish Catholic, yeah.
You're Irish guy.
I'm about 99% Irish.
That black Irish thing is what you got, right?
I guess so, yeah. I always loved that term as a kid.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, my mom told me I had jet black hair when I was a kid, and that's one of my favorite compliments.
Black Irish to me, like, I never knew what it meant, and then it just became like this menacing thing.
Yeah.
Like, the black Irish are like, they're very, you know, intense looking and nothing but trouble.
You're not sunny and red haired,
right,
and you don't have a limerick at hand.
Nope.
It's the Irish goodbye people who leave a party without telling anyone.
That's right. The brooding kind.
I guess so.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. The Eugene.
I think out of the two, it's probably the more attractive to be.
I don't know. I mean, you know, having a happy redheaded disposition. I'm glad, actually, as I say that out loud, I'm glad.
Do you have cousins who are redheads? Do you have friends who are redheads? I don't know many redheads, really.
Redheads on my mom's side.
I'm not against them.
Well, there's lots of lore about not trusting them.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they untrustable, the redheads?
I've heard such things.
Share some of that lore.
I just heard Bernie Brillstein. I didn't know Bernie Brillstein.
Sure.
I just heard he said that you should never trust. Well, he said never trust a redheaded Jew was
interesting.
The thing.
There are a few of those.
I've heard that many times. As quoted to Bernie Brillstein, it was not something.
Yeah, and your parents were high educated working people.
Yeah, they're both lawyers.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. My mom's a law professor at Northwestern University.
Well, that's noble. She probably believes that the law is a good thing.
She
and
does.
That people
they
should treat
do.
It with respect.
Yes, we were very, it was a lawyerly upbringing.
And your father, what kind of lawyer is he?
He's a corporate lawyer. He does mergers and acquisitions.
See, now that sounds that doesn't sound like, you know, completely on the level to me.
How's that?
I don't know. Mergers and acquisitions.
It's definitely not pro bono, but.
No, I know. I just don't, when you start talking mergers and acquisitions, I feel people are losing their jobs and crying.
Well.
That's life, right?
No, I'm not going to say that's life. Sometimes companies need to merge. And he was, he would help
them do
that.
It's not his problem, whatever.
It's not his problem.
You know, he's just trying to do it right and protect everybody.
Yes, absolutely.
Who's merging and
who's
acquiring
merging and acquiring,
things. Yeah, for those corporations.
For those, made up of people.
Yeah.
Just ordinary
there's
people.
There's no reason to think that, though. Just treat the corporation as its own entity, as an individual.
That's what we're supposed to do now, right?
That's what the law says.
That's what the law
says. Seems crazy to me, John.
All companies are an individual.
Yeah.
So he's just helping little folks.
That's right, the little folks.
Yeah.
Like Procter Gamble.
Sure.
That little guy.
Maybe not P&G, but
no,
why not?
Yeah, that's a bad one. Is it?
I don't know. Every comic in Cincinnati would work for P&G, I remember.
Really? Because
when you go to Go Bananas, everyone would work for their job was P&G.
Oh, really? Because that's where it was located?
Yeah, they had a big office.
That's
there,
where the hell was it? In Indianapolis, it was the pharmaceutical company. Lilly, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Everyone at Crackers worked for Lilly?
Well, no, but it was there, Looming, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And then comics in Chicago would work for, like, Leo Burnett, the advertising agency.
Really?
Yeah, there were always these, like, sort of home offices where it's like, well, I could get a day job at Leo Burnett. Yeah.
And some advertising agencies have temp jobs, right? There was temping?
Yeah, that's probably what they were doing.
What did you do when you were a punk?
When I was, like, day jobbing it, I was an intern over at Comedy Central. Then I was a temp at Comedy Central, and then I wrote freelance wholesale ad copy. So for like big catalogs of tchotchkes and stuff, I would write the descriptions of them for the catalog.
But Comedy Central's in New York, no?
Mm-hmm. I never lived in Chicago.
What?
After I was a kid. I mean, that's not true. I lived there for 18 years. Then I went to school, and then I moved right to New York.
Really? And that was it?
That was
it. See you later, Chicago?
Yeah, I did. I never started in Chicago. It was weird because it was like, Second City and tons of stand-up was there, but I just never did it there.
Why did you run away from Chicago, John?
Well, I didn't want to start in front of my family.
Why?
Because I wanted to
feel like you're out in the world.
Yeah.
Doing your own thing.
Doing my own thing, and
I'll
occasionally
see you guys
asking
later
for money.
Yeah. Wish me luck. I might need a check occasionally.
I might need $500 tomorrow.
But when did the trouble happen? Because I know that we're both sober guys. We established that on our last podcast.
Yeah. Oh, our last one was at Comics.
Yeah, it was comics. Yeah, remember comics?
Comics Live.
But like you, how long are you sober now?
September 22nd, 2005. So 10 years will be next fall.
So really? So you just got 9 years?
Yeah.
Or so.
Yeah.
I just had 15. Thank you.
Congratulations.
I appreciate that.
15.
Yeah.
Wow.
And God damn it, do I want to drink?
You do?
Not really.
Yeah. Not
I'm
really.
Uncomfortable though.
Sure. I want
a
relief.
Squirrely.
I'd like a ripcord, but
relief.
Yeah,
that's all it is.
I mean, it seems like it'll be relief, but
right. But that's the feeling, like, because I have that feeling a lot when people ask me, "Are you happy? Do you want to be happy?" I just would like to be. I want some relief.
I always wish I had just a ripcord next to me. Like, I should wear a parachute and just feel it occasionally and go, okay, it's there, even though you don't want to deploy a parachute on the street.
Well, we're both falling, is what you're saying. We're falling at a high speed.
I constantly feel a feeling of falling. I don't know enough about physics. Neil deGrasse Tyson could explain why that
we're
is.
We're plummeting right now.
Yeah, we're constantly plummeting.
Oh, my God. So hopefully we won't hit the ground since we don't have parachutes. We'll just go. Yeah, that's what you do. You just adapt to the feeling of plummeting.
Yes.
But so 9 years, so you were like, what, 23, 24?
I was 23. I got started doing everything young, so.
But you grew up in like a nice, upper middle class.
I had no excuse.
No, I mean, but that's, it's easier in a way because people don't expect you to necessarily be fucked up.
True.
Yeah.
And I just had a real, I remember a psychiatrist told me when I was young, he said, half of you is this really nice guy. I was very polite, and the other half of you is a gorilla whose job is to kill the other half.
Exactly.
And I thought, okay, that sounds right. So I had this inclination.
I talk about that a lot, the two voices.
Yeah.
It's weird. Have you decided what the authentic you is? Or is it just, it's still up in the air?
I think the authentic me is the nice guy who's very aware of the gorilla and goes, stay over there, gorilla. No way, not today.
Things are going all right today.
Things are going okay at the moment.
Wow.
Stay over there, gorilla.
So I can't imagine you as just out of control. What did that look like?
Everyone says that. Yeah, it's fun. My wife is always like, I wish I could spend a day with you as an out of control.
You know what that sounds like? That sounds like someone wants you to drink.
Yeah. That would be wonderful for her. What a delight that would be. To go back to it.
Come on,
now.
John, just one day.
To go back to it and after 4 months of marriage for her to see that.
She just wants to know you, John. She wants to know all of you.
That's true. That was an interesting person. A confident person. At moments. Please.
Full of bravado and bluster.
I had a lot of bravado. I had a lot of ideas.
But like, what were you doing? So you started drinking when, what, you're 14?
Yeah, 13, 14, yeah.
And you were just drinking with your friends?
Yeah, we just drank a lot. I think we just had an unhealthy familiarity with drinking and drugs early. And
Why is that?
It was around a lot.
Culturally?
Was
your older brother or sister? Were they?
They were very responsible. I think they drank in the high school sense.
Right.
That was about it.
Just laughing. It's just fun on weekends and someone holds somebody's hair and you don't drink for a month.
Yeah, you don't drink for a month, right? Right. You'd have that one incident.
Yeah.
I never had like an incident in high school. I was very, looking back, I was very careful to keep it going, which is interesting. I didn't want to come home and
don't want to fuck
everywhere.
That up.
Yeah.
Right. Got a good thing going.
And I did feel a sense of pride in that I kept my parents out of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'd come home and go, I'm home. I'm going to bed. And just like, you know, make
so
it
they didn't know?
As quick as I could. I think they knew we drank some. I don't think they knew that we were messing around with a lot of stuff. But then,
really? What stuff?
You know, we were doing like, we were smoking pot and drinking, and then we did coke and stuff like
some
that.
Did some blow.
Yeah, we were those types of kids.
Oh,
yeah.
So somebody had the good allowance.
Yeah, and also just, or just terrible coke that teenagers could afford.
This is someone knew a guy.
Yeah, we were just like, we'd take like Ritalins and Adderalls to
that
do schoolwork, and then we'd do that stuff, other stuff at night, and drink a lot. And this is towards later high school and then into college. And then in college... So
in college, you're a free man. Where are you going to college?
To Georgetown.
So you're in D.C.?
I'm in D.C.
And now the sky's the limit.
Sure.
Yeah, man. You're free. You got some money coming in every month.
It was more like everyone had a tiny bit of money and would buy pot and coke and stuff like that.
But what did the bottom look like? What were you studying at Georgetown?
I was an English and theology major.
Huh. I was an English major. Theology, huh? Were you a God guy?
Oh, yeah. I believe in God, yeah.
You do? Undeniably. Not even second-guessing it, ever.
Of course. Constantly second-guessing it. All the time.
Did you grow up with the hell?
Sure. Oh, yeah. Irish Catholic. Like, Catholic.
I know, but your parents are lawyers. They're smart people.
They are smart people.
Smart people don't believe in hell.
Yes, they do.
All right.
You know, despite... Religulous, or whatever that shit was.
Well, you studied theology. You're a practical person. You're a practical person.
I studied a lot of Jewish theology, though. I was mainly interested in that. That very much lined up with my personal outlook.
What specifically?
There's a God. He might not like us.
Yeah.
And there might not be nothing else after this. So let's focus on this.
And you're free to talk to him at length about anything.
Sure.
And sometimes there are arguments. And
you can shake your fist.
Sure. Yeah. He can take that. God can handle that.
That he can handle that was also very, yes.
Yeah.
It wasn't this like, oh, this is a friendship. I was like, this isn't a friendship.
No, this is a difficult relationship.
This is
and I've got questions.
Right.
And if you're not going to answer them, me and these guys are going to just kind of go over them over and over again.
Right. It's like working for like an aloof famous person where you just talk about him when he's out of the room endlessly.
So it's a group of assistants.
We're a pool of us. Not we, because I'm unfortunately not
a pool of Talmudic
Jewish
assistants.
Yes. Writing a midrash to understand their boss.
So you were like what? Reading the Kabbalah, reading the Talmud, studying that, writing papers on the Jews?
Yeah. Torah, Talmud.
Kabbalah? And... You didn't get into
No, I don't think we did really
Kabbalah. Didn't do
Kabbalah.
The mystical stuff? It was probably like, that's only for special people.
There was a class on Jewish mysticism that I don't think I took. No, mm-hmm. I didn't take it. And no, I got, I think the last class I took when I was a senior was theology after the Holocaust. So there was a much more.
That was the why did God let this happen?
What was that about?
Semester.
Yes, a semester of what was that about.
Yeah. How could he have let that happen?
Yeah. What does that mean? Yeah. And it meant a lot of the same questions they'd had forever.
Always the same questions.
Yeah.
So what was the focus of that course? Just sort of like, how did Judaism change within the community after
the
Holocaust?
Yeah. It was, the first course I took was Judaism, what was it called? Changing Tradition and Continued Practice. Mm-hmm. I liked that it adapted.
Mm-hmm. Were you just preparing for show business?
No, it was like, I think being raised religious.
I want to speak the language of the people I'll be working for.
Yeah, but I didn't take like a, you know, like a handbook of Yiddish, conversational Yiddish thing.
A year-long seminar in communicating with Lorne Michaels.
I had a book when I was a little kid called Yiddish as a Second Language. It was like a novelty book I somehow acquired.
Yeah.
I really liked that. Yes, I wanted to be Jewish.
You did?
Yeah, that was, I don't know why I'm.
Did you really?
Running away from that, yeah.
But how Catholic were you brought up? I mean, seriously?
Serious.
Talk to the priest?
Yeah. Go to confession. Go to church every Sunday.
I like the idea of confession. It seems like it's relieving. You must have gotten some
relief.
It's free
therapy, by the way. Like, it is just kind of the old thing of the screen and you kneel on one side and the priest and mm-hmm. you never see their face as portrayed in films and so forth. It actually became after... I guess, I don't know if it was Vatican II or just growing up in the 80s, it was like you sit in a room with a priest and tell them what's going on, and it's kind of, it was more like what therapy is like.
I mean, except so there was a back and
very
forth?
Different parameters. There was a back and forth.
Yeah.
When I first went to confession, though, I would make up...
It's different than therapy because many things are not okay.
That's true, but you don't... I was never like read a riot act in confession.
But it was
kind of like, well, of course, life's, you know, it's very hard and, you know, sometimes...
Right, and it's difficult, but you still, like, you need to ask forgiveness, and if you don't, there's going to be...
Yeah. And I got to say, like, the idea that the creator of the universe would forgive you for individual things you did wrong is a nice feeling.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
Because you think he's busy, but I'm glad he could make the time to... Take a load off
he
of
let
me.
Let me know that I was square with him.
Yeah, you're okay. You can you masturbated. It's okay.
Well, see, what I would do was I would make up wholesome sounding sins because I had to go to confession, right? So I'd go in and I'd be like, oh, me and my brother were throwing snowballs at a house and someone told us to stop. And even after they left, I threw two more snowballs because I just had to make up like Norman Rockwell sounding sins when really it was like,
jerking off,
humping my bed like a maniac.
Right, but so you never came clean on that stuff. You just kind of make what? How did you actually?
No,
feel
I never.
Forgiven?
No, I never said that out loud. No,
really.
Well, I have to say I knew enough to know that that stuff was fine.
But throwing snowballs was a big problem.
No, I just needed to get through the session. You ever go to a psychiatrist or therapist and you don't have anything that day, so you just need to make something up to get through the session?
Well, I'll talk about something and pay him for it.
Exactly. So sometimes I'll go to my shrink and I'll be like, I got to think of something to focus on.
Yeah, and
for these 45 minutes, and I exaggerate whatever the problem is, just so it sounds like it's a thing.
Oh, really? No, for me, it just ends up being like a regular conversation I could have with a friend over coffee. Like sometimes I'll be like, did you see that show? What do you think
talk
of that
about
show?
True Detective?
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, I got nothing against Catholics. I mean, I don't want people to get the wrong idea. I'm a little hard on Catholics because the Catholics and the Jews, these are ancient religions. Have you been to Rome? Have you been to Florence? Have you done
I've been to Rome. I've been to Jerusalem.
You see all the dead wizards in caskets?
And wizard parts. Statues of wizards.
Yeah, crypts and coffins. And
crypts.
Each church has a part of somebody, a piece, a finger,
yeah,
a toe.
Yeah, they have like, or a piece
relish.
Of a shirt.
Sure,
yeah,
sure.
A piece of a
You
pant.
Went to Israel too because you were fascinated?
I've been to Israel, yeah. I went to Israel with my dad in 07.
Really?
Yeah.
And why'd you...
That was the best trip I ever took in my life.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
It's amazing. There's an energy to that whole place that's just incredible.
Crazy.
Yeah. And so we landed in Tel Aviv and then went up through like Caesarea, the Roman ruins, went through the Golan, came down. The Golan was really interesting because I was like, oh, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
Like you hear about the Golan Heights, but you never realize, like, what are people fighting for? And you get up there and you go, oh, this is nice.
Yeah. It was just
this would
you
be
and your
horrible
dad?
To be dispossessed from here.
Yeah.
Yeah, just my dad and I and a guide named Menachem.
And you decided to go to Israel?
Former Israeli colonel.
They're all former Israeli colonels.
Well, anyway. That's true. But this guy never let you forget it.
Oh, yeah.
We were at the Wailing Wall, and he was against, not against, he didn't like that there were, you know, that. Young females were also enlisted when they were 18.
Right.
So we were just leaning against the car near the Wailing Wall, and Menachem looked at this 18-year-old girl holding a, you know, M16 or whatever, and said, "You see that girl there? I could disarm her in 2.5 seconds."
That was it. He didn't say that about the men, just that.
No, just that girl. Yeah, but he was also tiny, by the way. He was about 1'3".
Yeah,
yeah.
Why'd you guys choose Israel?
My parents travel a lot. We took interesting trips when I was a kid. My dad took great vacations when he was young with his dad. He went to Africa and South America, and we'd always wanted to go there. And I was, you know, I was out of college at that point.
Yeah.
I studied a lot of Judaism, and I just really wanted to go.
Did you read Hebrew and stuff?
No, I don't read Hebrew. It was, this was just, you know, so English translations.
Was this right after college that you went?
A couple of years, yeah.
And were you drinking still?
No, I was done by then.
What was your bottom like? Did it happen in college? I mean, like...
after college. It had to happen after college because that was when I realized that other people weren't still doing this as much.
Oh, right. You were like, hey, where are you guys going?
Yeah, yeah. Why don't we, for the next 72 hours, why don't we?
Yeah,
and everyone
come
was
on,
like,
man.
No, you know.
It's not time for bed.
Yeah. It was still young. However, I will say it was apparent that other people had moved on.
Right.
College was over.
And you felt stupid.
I felt stupid. I just felt... I thought... I've been coasting on the idea that I'm a good person now for maybe 5 years. I remember what it felt like to be, to feel good about myself. And that was about 5 years ago. And that flicker would kind of help me get through times. But I was like, I don't.
So you're starting to feel a little corrupted.
I remember thinking to myself, if I was watching this person in a movie, this was the day I stopped. I thought if I was watching this guy in a movie, I wouldn't be rooting for him anymore.
He took
no matter what happened to him,
he took a
turn. He had a breakup, blah, blah. Just, I wouldn't care by
that. That guy's no good.
It'd just be like one of those 3-hour movies where you're like, I don't care. They can all die.
Yeah. That was it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel like you were in trouble?
Yes. I knew I was not. I knew I was. So in part, they were fun to do drugs, but also you'd get attention for doing them. Mm-hmm. And I knew that, like, well, then people would be worried about me. And then that was an interesting amount of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, girls would be concerned. Even if they'd broken up with you, they'd be, oh, are you okay?
So
they'd
they're
check
still
in
kind of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Cocaine doesn't make girls like you, but it does make them worry about you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, what do you
and
need?
And were you like, what do you care?
Yeah, what do you care? Call me back.
Yeah.
I might do something bad.
I'm in trouble.
Yeah, I'm in trouble. Don't call me. Call me. So then that was all over. I was just like, I'm not, this is nothing but doing it.
Yeah, so it was coke, really.
Well, I'm drinking a ton. I just drink and make bad decisions.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, coke keeps you drinking.
Sure, keeps you awake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For more drinking.
Yeah.
But were you were you a hostile drunk?
Yes, by the end.
Oh,
I
really?
Could really snarl.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
No fights, though? You don't look like you've taken
But I'd like...
Too many punches.
I'd like... No, I've never... exactly. you can tell that just by looking at me, but as a type, like if you were at a party and you had a cup, I'd like, I remember a friend telling me, like, I saw you, You were on the other side of the room and you came right for me, just dead eyed. And I walked up to him and I slapped the cup out of his hand and just stared at him. And he was like, you know, fuck you, John.
Right, right.
But I had that kind of like, I'd flick your tie and go like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
I'm
not a phony. You're a phony.
You're a pest.
I was a pest. I was a nuisance.
You're like that guy.
A little drunk nuisance.
Here he comes.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got that look in his eye.
And I looked 12.
And you were kind of a dick is what you were.
I was becoming a dick. Yeah.
And what did you hang the primary feelings on? Like, you know, were you unhappy with yourself? What was it? Were you chomping at the bit? Were you doing comedy yet? Did you not?
I was doing a little bit of comedy, but I didn't want to do, like, I'd started in college. I really liked the first rush. And then I was like, oh, you just got to keep doing it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't do well and other people are doing well. I really wanted to have done comedy.
Sure, I know.
I remember
like
around 2021, I was like, I just wish I'd already done a lot of it and could say I did it.
So you're hard on yourself.
I was hard on myself, sure. But I also wasn't doing enough. Like I was just talking about how I wanted to be a comedian or was a comedian or whatever. And
to all the girls on coke when you were like, I'm just going to do it, man.
Yes. Yeah, oh, yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And so I'd sort of stretch things I've done.
Yeah, sitting there.
If I did it, if I was at Stand Up New York when there was a Conan showcase, I'd done it, but I hadn't. Yet.
Oh, so you're a liar.
Yes, I was a liar, too. I was a real liar.
I was never, I'm only a liar if it's absolutely necessary.
Now I am. And that was the hardest thing to wean myself off of were lies of convenience.
Just lies because you could?
I remember feeling that after I stopped drinking. I was like, oh, right. I haven't used that muscle of explaining the truth in a long time.
Right.
I would just say, oh, my phone was broken, or I'd just make something up.
Right.
The idea that I would now have to say, I miscalculated the time and I'm sorry, you know?
It's hard, right?
It is hard.
Yeah. So, but you used to just lie for the hell of it.
Yeah, I lied for the hell of it. I lied to be grandiose, and I lied to get out of trouble or to not deal with any inconveniences at all.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a great tool.
Sure, it's very convenient. A lot of people don't check up on your lies at all. Or you get in one of those situations where you've lied so much, people are like, okay. And they don't even second guess you because they used to.
You're not even credible anymore.
No, you're not. You're just a
sure, John.
A hostile witness.
Yeah. Yeah. Okie doke.
Okay, we're not going to question this guy anymore.
Yeah. So when did you start doing comedy in earnest? I mean, so you moved from D.C. to New York when? You graduated?
Yeah, I graduated.
Did you do well?
I did pretty good. Yeah. I always tried to keep up appearances, like I said, so that I didn't have to deal with anything.
Right.
Let's see. When I was 20, I came to New York and I was interning at Comedy Central in New York.
For who?
For Jesse Klein and Lou Wallach.
Lou Wallach was the head of Comedy Central at the time?
Yeah. Or? It was the summer of the Graham Norton effect.
Oh, big summer.
Big summer. We all remember where we were.
The big summer of failure. The Graham Norton effect.
Yeah, but then there was also Chappelle's show, Daily Show, South Park. It was a cool place to be. There was still Let's Bowl and stuff like that. That was the summer of 2003.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Jesse was development person.
She was a development person at that time. Lou was there, you know, Naomi.
Frisch?
Yep. Yeah.
And what were you doing?
Whatever.
Yeah.
I like deliver stuff to tough crowd.
Right.
I was
on that show occasionally.
Yes, you were.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah, loved it. It was exciting. Real things happened.
Yeah, I went to a lot of tapings of that. That was fun.
Now, did you work with Nick in...
In college, yeah.
And Aziz and those guys?
Oh, yeah. I met Aziz when I moved to New York.
But you weren't part of Human Giant.
No, I never did anything on that show. But we were all kind of around Rafifi in those places. And
Well,
Aziz
Eugene
had just
Merman's
been at NYU.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Eugene's show, Invite Them Up. That was like the show to get on.
Right. So that was a whole new generation. You were like... really literally part of the next generation, the next wave of comedy in New York.
And I had a very, looking back, had a very comfy time because of that. It was very friendly.
You didn't have to do open mics at stand-up clubs.
I did some. I do Hamburger Harry's.
So that was early on. Sure. Right. So you were running around doing those kind of
things. Yeah, I'd do those shows, Rock Albers. And
so you started to do comedy in earnest when you were doing the internship.
Yeah, I was about 20.
Right.
Yeah.
And I
would do the B3 every week at 3rd and Avenue B. And Comedy Kebab in Brooklyn.
Right.
But
not stand up, not like the comic strip. You didn't hang
around. I went up at the comic strip once for Lucian Hold.
Right.
Birbiglia got me a spot
Yeah.
to go up in front of him.
Yeah. And he said, oh, I've got enough white guys.
Well, Mike went in the other room. He goes, I'll ask Lucian what he thought.
Yeah.
And then he came out and he went, no, no. And I said, well, what did he say? And he apparently he watched me on the monitor and said, well, no. Like that. Which, having heard other stories about him, that was like, that's very tame.
Were you doing well?
I had like 2 good minutes wherein other comics would help me out.
Right.
But then there was a, I feel like a year of like, then that was it. You know, I could like get a spot and invite them up and do well. And then, you know, you'd get another spot months later.
Right.
And I was like, I'd have nothing new then. So it in that world of like, okay, these 3 minutes kind of work in downtown New York. That plateaued really fast.
Right.
So I started going on the road right then. I remember I was hosting at the Nashville.
What do you mean going on the road?
I would.
As a feature?
No, as an MC.
Oh, really?
My first MC week was at the Penguins in Cedar Rapids.
So was that under the tutelage of Mike Birbiglia?
Yes. I was opening for Mike. So I was hosting. You know,
right. So Mike said, you got to do comedy clubs. That's how I started. But that was still pretty cush.
That was still very nice to have someone getting me into those clubs.
And also his audience, I imagine, was fairly.
He was right at the point where he'd done like a Comedy Central half hour. So
just starting to build it.
He had a lot of people knew who he was, but he still would have, I think, some of those nights where the audience was just there for Zanies or there for Penguins.
Right. So, you know? But he got you into that experience. He got you working as a comic.
Absolutely. And realizing I sucked.
At a year in.
Absolutely. And realizing I wasn't a comic, I was like a writer of jokes.
But he helped you?
Yes.
Do you feel permanently in debt?
Oh, absolutely.
Indebted to Mike
Birbiglia? Oh, yeah. I went on the road for him for 30 days straight.
Uh-huh.
And that was like a huge turning point.
It was a lesson.
Well, the lesson for me was like before that tour with Mike, I always wanted the show to be canceled. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to have done a show and be...
wanted it behind you.
Yes, I wanted it behind me. And that, after doing 30 days straight where you just had to... I had to MC every night, I started to want to do the show itself.
So you were getting into it.
Yeah.
You started to get it. You watched
Mike.
He
also told me in a very like cool, direct way. He was like, hey, you have to be better if you're going to open these shows. In a very like, hey, you can't like, you know.
But your joke writing.
You can't softly throw your jokes under the bus and act like you don't give a shit when you do.
Well, that's a good point because that's like a defense mechanism.
Absolutely. And it also felt like you had to start. Or I felt I had to be, it felt like at Rafifi, places like that, you had to begin clumsily and act clumsy.
Yeah, you had to act cute and undermine yourself in order.
Yeah, the best joke would
be
a joke.
Don't tell me you don't know how to act cute.
I knew how to do that.
Okay, yeah.
But in Nashville, when I had to, you know, do the announcements that Killer Bees was coming,
sure.
I had to bring the fucking energy.
Better save up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James Gregory, the funniest man in America, will be here next week. And now let's make some noise for your headliner.
Yeah.
Mike Birbiglia.
So, but he taught you, he gave you a sort of work ethic. He told you what was wrong with the way you were presenting your jokes. He obviously had faith in you as a joke writer.
Yeah. He thought I was very funny. I'd like, you know, followed him around a lot and would try to pitch jokes to him and stuff. And,
right,
I think
for
he
him,
thought I was
mean?
A funny guy. Yeah, because one time when I was visiting, he was working on his half hour special, and I just went with him like everywhere when he was running.
Did you help
Dangerfields? And no, not really. In the end, I was so excited just to he go, what do you think of this? And I go, that's great.
Well, it's interesting because you are joke heavy. I mean, you are a joke teller. You have a very fast pace. You are a written guy.
Yeah,
you're not necessarily riffing.
No, no, more so now, but not for a long time.
Right, yeah. Right. When I saw you, I mean, you were doing something a little more personal. I saw you at, where did I see you? I saw you at a small theater of some kind. Why were you doing?
Was it Montreal?
Maybe. It was a long set about
Catherine Theater.
Proctological examination.
Yeah, yeah. They had.
Oh, it was your one person show. Right. I did a show there and I went to see your one man show.
Yes, you came. I was very flattered by that.
Yeah, yeah. It was great. But that was you venturing into autobiographical stuff. Because my recollection of you previous to that was, you know, very clever clever jokes with a lot of good references,
right.
Many of which I didn't get because I'm too old.
Right. I'd do a joke about the movie Ray.
Yeah.
And it would be good for a month.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was sort of what you did.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That was how you conceived. What? But did you?
But I had no sense of myself, or not that I do yet now. But
that's sort of a weird, dodgy topic for you in a way.
What's that?
Well, just, you know, who's in there, John?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, because like I can hear like sometimes your laugh is a little up here. It's not as deep as it should be.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, like, you know, you're very together. But like, because when I saw the one-man show, I was excited for you because I thought, well, you know, he's stepping out. He's going to do some stuff. There's a moment there during the proctological exam where, you know, where I was like, are we gay? Are we not gay? What's happening?
Right, right, right.
And I was like, who is this guy? There's a, you know, you do keep it together somehow. You're kind of a controlled dude.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's for me to let out.
Right.
Right.
So what's going to make you lose your shit?
Get angry, you mean?
Whatever.
I don't get that angry.
Where is it all going, John?
I mean, probably internal organs. Or not doing well. I haven't gone to a doctor in 5-6 years.
You're fine.
I might be fine.
Come on.
I'm relaxing. Everything's relaxing.
Come on. You're not like this with your friends like Pete and everybody. You cut
on
loose.
Guard.
You're on guard?
No, I mean, am I?
I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. Depends.
Is this something that you've heard before? Am I telling you?
Absolutely.
This?
All the time.
Yeah? Really?
Sure.
From your wife?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you're
not in a terrible way. Not like, are you...
Where are you, John? Spacking
right.
Around.
Yeah, who's in there?
Yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, there's no there, yeah. As my parents used to say about Bill Clinton. Yeah.
Oh, did they? Yeah?
There's no there.
Sure.
So who has a there all the time?
Yeah, no. It's submerged.
Sure.
It's for you to know.
It's for me to know. I don't have to give that to anyone.
Well, what? I thought you were a comedian.
Well, I give it out in the doses I want to.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, fine. That's fine, John.
Do you think I don't?
I don't know.
Okay, you're just asking.
Well, no, I think that sometimes, like, here's the deal. Like, I listen to your record. I watch you perform. When I saw you do the story show, I was like, all right, so now I get an idea. Like, I had no idea who you were. And I watched you, and I'd listened to your stuff before, and I'm like, he's great. He's got, you know, good clips, got good pace, got good jokes. But who is that guy?
Sure.
But then again, I've been saying about Seinfeld for 30 years. Like, I'm like, I don't know who that guy is. How can I watch a guy for an hour and have no fucking idea who he is? It bothers me. As time goes on, I realize who Jerry is, and it's not terrific. But the thing is, but you know, it's just like, if I can't see somebody's vulnerability,
right?
You know, almost immediately, I'm like, I don't know, either he's really confident or he's fucking with me.
Interesting.
Is it?
Yes.
Because like
the fucking with me part of it.
Well, yeah, but that's my own problem. It's just sort of like, you know what, you know, it's evasive. I know that comedy being innately funny is a defense mechanism in and of itself, but it should reveal some insecurity. And I think that that it may be there, but like until I saw you, you know, tell stories about your life, I just didn't have a sense of who you were with just a stand-up.
That's totally fair.
And now you're evolving out of that. You're changing.
Yeah, and also I have a life now. I only had those jokes before.
Yeah.
I only had TV shows and bullshit I'd
But were you done as a kid. Was that the craft? Are you like, well, even but it tells different, because it tell, like, you know, he can't help but, you know, see exactly who he is. But was writing jokes for you sort of like doodling, like a math equation, like it was just something you were
doing? I thought of a joke. That's great. I'll put it in my stand-up act.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No matter what the topic was, you know.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I remember I started off trying to write jokes about topics no one else had jokes about.
Yeah, like what?
Like the Liberty Bell. I wrote a joke about the Liberty
what
Bell.
What was that?
It was that it's... I remember writing it because I'd never heard a joke about the Liberty Bell.
Yeah.
How precious is that?
Yeah, no, it's good. I think
the joke was that it's supposed to be this patriotic symbol, but it's broken. So mm-hmm. It's like we fought this war for our independence, and the first thing we do is break something nice. Like we're a bunch of special ed kids who finally get unsupervised recess, and we come in after 30 minutes like Ernie fell. That was the joke.
So there's a lot of words in there.
I know. Look how rapidly I got through it, avoiding eye contact with you.
But that was your style. It just keeps going.
It keeps going, sure.
Amazing clip, too. Do you ever, like, when you take pause, when everything sort of slows down,
yeah.
What do you feel? Uncomfortable?
I feel very comfortable on stage.
Right, now, yeah.
Yeah. You saw my worst set ever, I think.
At that one-man show?
No, in Aspen.
Did I?
Yes. You don't remember that? Of course you wouldn't. That was a huge moment in my life and not...
But I was there.
You were the host. I met you that weekend. I hosted for you and Tosh. You guys were co-headlining a show. This was...
Oh, my God.
You were wearing American Apparel jackets and overcoats a lot during that time.
Sure, sure.
So you were very nice to me.
Yeah.
I had just seen you on Conan. Yeah. And I really like that joke you did about your mom calling you and asking you what you thought of this guy Sabu. And you saying, "Mom, do you mean Barack Obama?" So I told you that at the Tosh. I got to host for you and Tosh. And then I think you were co-headlining show with Showalter and Mary Lynn.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That's right. And then I did my second. So you have these showcases at Aspen. You do like, it was me and it wasn't Kyle Kinane and Dan Mintz, but they were also there that year. So it was like people that age group, we would go, we'd do our 5-minute sets. And I kind of, I didn't do well the first one. So then I hosted for you and Tosh. I did a little better. And then this was like the second showcase that I was going to do. And it was in the big tent.
Yeah.
You remember that thing?
Yeah.
And I walked up on stage and I started to talk. It was you reminded me of it when you said my laugh was up here. I couldn't breathe at all.
It's hard to breathe there.
Couldn't breathe at all, though. And my first joke,
I remember this,
died. Now. It died. And then
oh my God, I remember
white
this.
Hot panic rolled over me.
Right, but you were having trouble.
Like, I was having real trouble, both in the bombing sense, and also I couldn't breathe. And to this day, I don't know if I was having a panic attack or elevation sickness.
But there was like concern. Like you got off stage and it was like you were fucked up.
Yeah, you and Mike DiStefano were very nice to me backstage. They got me an oxygen tank.
I remember this now. Right.
And Mike DiStefano sat with me for a little while. You came and checked on me, which I always never forgot. You were very cool in that moment. And you came on stage and so I bomb and almost die. You come back on stage and said some nice things about my set and kind of used one of my jokes to get into one of your jokes. I remember hearing it and going, oh, he's really trying to make it seem like that went fine. And it really didn't. And everyone was there. I remember some guy that worked for like Conoco was in the front row.
Right.
And I was like, he saw me bomb. I'll never go to Conoco.
Yeah. I remember this now. It's coming back to me.
Right. And so I was really like, I'm done.
I was in bad shape because that must have been right after my wife left. And I must have
Your wife was there.
Oh, that was that time.
Yes.
What year was that? 2006, maybe.
2006. Okay. Yeah, 2006.
Right. That's where I went up on stage and did the storytelling show that was end of my marriage. I remember she was there. I remember running into Stephen Wright. I remember hosting that thing because I remember like Stephen Baldwin was one of the
Billy.
Billy Baldwin was on the show with me.
Yeah.
And he was around. Yes. And backstage at that tent thing. That's right. I remember bits and pieces.
You were
hanging
out with your wife and Billy Baldwin.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Now, I remember being backstage, and then I'd go outside, smoke cigarettes, and I was drinking coffee backstage. This is why I also wonder if I had like a panic attack.
You were smoking then?
Yeah, I was smoking in Aspen Elevation for the first time. I mean, I don't know why.
No, it's hard to breathe. So, okay, so I saw one of the worst sets. I do not remember it that way. I do remember that you were in trouble.
No one remembered it at all because everyone was so drunk.
Right.
And
it was
a rough night.
It was weird because there was industry there, but there's also a lot of like drunky regular people.
Oh, there were like men in fur coats in the front row.
Right, because it was sort
of beautiful bronze.
Was it outdoors and heated kind of thing?
There were heat lamps in a tent in the middle of cold Aspen.
Yeah, it was weird, man.
Only Dan Mintz remembers it. He was in the back of the tent and he brings it up all the time as just, he said it was like watching a beautiful train wreck because I came out confident, and the jokes were probably pretty good.
Yeah,
but there was nothing doing from second one.
Right,
and as soon as nothing was happening, I remember that feeling of air from like the bot. Just I had air in my throat and nowhere else.
Oh,
it was
horrendous.
Terrifying.
Right,
and I went long because my closers kept not working.
Right,
so I did more closers.
Yeah, and I remember like when you got off, you were like in trouble.
Yeah, I hated all, it was like, when you faint and everyone surrounds you, I hated all the attention so much.
Right.
I wanted to absolutely die.
But it turned out okay.
Yeah, but I was so scared. I it's funny, I remember you and Mike DiStefano being really nice.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's gonna be okay, you're fucking funny, it doesn't matter, I got a meeting with James Dixon. He told me that while I was breathing in air. I got a meeting with James Dixon.
Well, I'm glad that you have a good memory of me. That's nice.
I have a lot of nice ones. You were always very nice to me.
All right, so then, like, let's get up to where everything starts to change. So you intern at Comedy Central for how long?
Oh, just a year.
So you come back from the road with
about 06. I'm kind of starting to feature. I did right. Conan for the first time.
Right.
Then I went and did Aspen and bombed. Right. And almost died.
Well, it was you need to take the hits sometimes.
You got to take hits.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of off. I was like on the road. Sometimes with Birbiglia, sometimes on my own. Started doing that show Best Week Ever.
Yeah.
On VH1. So that was easy.
Talking head guy?
Yeah. You just go to Midtown, you go to that 1633 Broadway building and talk in front of colored paper for like an hour.
Yeah.
You get a couple hundred bucks. That was a very good time. And then I did like a NACA.
Sure.
Right? Hosted a NACA.
That's the National Association of Colleges or whatever.
Yeah, it's the National Association of Bombing in a Hotel Ballroom. And then
in front of a lot of student activities people.
In front of a lot of student activities people who can often be very interesting people. And then you stand in a booth.
Yeah, selling yourself.
Yes, to like Sword Swallowers and the principal from Saved by the Bell.
With your headshots up on the wall.
Sure.
But what's at stake there is that, you know, you theoretically, if you got 20 colleges for the year, that's a lot of money for a guy starting
out. I remember
out.
I got 5, and that was a lot of money.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And then I did that.
How'd you do with the kids?
Medium. Yeah. I was like young looking, but my jokes weren't college fun.
Right.
It was a weird fit.
You're Black Irish.
Yeah. There was a darkness that they didn't appreciate.
You have a history. Yeah.
They wanted me to do like, you know, just...
You were the guy that knocked cups out of people's hands, and you were hiding that now.
And I would flip ties.
Yeah. That was not who you were. This is the new John. They would have liked the old John.
Yeah, sort of. But they wanted like fun college, and I only had like strange darkness of college. Like, mm-hmm. You ever just put on a hoodie and put on your headphones and walk?
Smoke cigarettes by
drunk.
Yourself?
Yeah. Think about everything. Think your life's over, even though
when
you're like
when did you get
19.
Off the smokes?
I've had them in the past couple months.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, you were never a big smoker.
No, I was. I smoked a lot at Saturday Night Live.
Yeah?
And then smoked all through college.
I like knowing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes me feel better about you.
Oh, I have many addictions and issues that I have to grapple with like that.
Like what else?
Well, I have to avoid a lot of things.
Like what?
Well, just like, anytime I take a Klonopin, I want 3.
No, I know that one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's and cigarettes. I go like, why are you chain smoking? Oh, because you are still trying to fill some void.
Is it just a void? Maybe you're not. I want you to be angry. I think you're angry.
I have anger, but it diffuses quickly.
Hmm.
I'd say that.
That doesn't sound very Black Irish to me.
Well,
you mean you're just a brooder?
I'm very also like just
sober
USA too.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
I had a very nice upbringing despite things I did to myself.
And also, I think things are, you know, went pretty well for you.
Yes. And also, we were one of those families where it was like, hey, you know, things could be worse. Look at that guy. He's got hooks for hands at the hot dog stand and stuff. So I was always putting things in perspective was like...
You had some gratitude all the way through.
All yeah. Very much so. Yeah.
Right. So when do you get the gig at... how do you get... SNL, how's that?
I auditioned in the summer of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd written for a couple shows. I wrote on Dimitri Martin's Comedy Central show for a summer, and then I worked on this pilot with Mike Black and Mike Showalter, and then but I was still just kind of doing stand up was the.
But these guys respected you. You must look good on the page.
I had like a funny packet for each, you know.
Yeah.
And then I auditioned in August of 08 for SNL. I found out on a Tuesday I was going to audition on a Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just was like, I cannot put together a audition of impressions and shit like that. So I just did stand up.
But was that ever your thing though? I mean,
no, but I thought I should.
Right.
Because everyone who was getting their audition ready was like writing all new pieces. Like I'm going to come up with 3 characters and then a Gordon Ramsay impression.
Right.
And I was like, I'll just eat shit if I do that. Right. So And I only had about 48 hours.
Right.
So I went out, I think I did like maybe Death Ray and then Jimmy Dore's show after it or something. And I was out in LA for some reason and I had to fly from LA to New York.
Right.
And I just went in 2 days later and did a stand-up set.
Right.
And I got hired as a writer.
Where was the audition?
It was actually on Conan's stage on the sixth floor of
30
Rock.
Oh, so you went right to 30 Rock. They didn't come see you at a club?
No, I'd done stuff. I'd done monologues for the ASCAT show that like Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler would do. So I'd met them a little.
Yeah.
And Seth recommended me to the show. And I'd been on Conan a couple times. So I think Ayala Cohn, who worked there, had seen tape of me or whatever.
And what was your experience meeting Lauren?
So I auditioned and I met him a few days later.
At his office?
Yeah, at his office.
Did you wait?
No, because I was there for another reason and they sprung the meeting on me. I didn't even know he was there.
Why were you there? Because you were already hired.
I was already hired. I think I was like, you know, moving a desk.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah.
I was in Higgins' office and they said, oh, Lauren's here, wants to talk to you. And I went in there and it was about a 1 minute meeting.
Uh-huh.
He just said, do you have siblings? And I said, yeah. And he said, where are they? And I said, oh, they're back in Chicago. And he went, they're back in Chicago. And now you're here. And I said, yeah. And he did say you were very funny, which was really nice.
Yeah.
And I said, thank you. So, you know, I went into this like, thank you so much. It's an honor. And he went, no. And just sort of waved that off.
Yeah.
And then that was it. Got up and walked out.
And you wrote there for how long?
4.5 years.
Was your first year hard?
My first year was not. It was scary, but it was really exciting. That that was fall of 08 when...
Who was the cast?
Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, Jason Sudeikis, Daryl Hammond, Amy Poehler, Seth Meyers.
Those seem like good people. It doesn't
great
it
people.
Sound like you got in, you know, after all the weird competitive...
110%. All that shit from the books that we've read, that was all over. Because Mike Shoemaker and Seth Meyers had created a really, really nice environment.
As the head writers.
As producers and head writers, it was just like the writers all worked together. There was no sense of competition.
What was Higgins at that time?
Yeah, Higgins was great too.
Was he the head writer? Who was the head writer?
Higgins was a producer. Seth was head writer.
Okay.
There was no sense of like, oh, this person gets iced out if it's their piece. Everyone's stuff was sort of enjoyed and heard, and the cast was so amazing, and... yeah, that was a really, really nice time. And then also that was the election of 2008, which was a very big time for the show.
Right.
So my first year was great. My first year was really fun. I came back. My second year was more like I thought I'd figured it out and got my ass kicked for the fall, sort of.
Yeah, but why? What?
I just was like, you know, figured I knew what I was doing. So when I would get stuff cut or get Lauren would get mad at me about something, it was like I was suddenly spinning out like I didn't.
He got mad at you?
Well, I mean, just get frustrated with a sketch or something under the bleachers. Like, really? You're going to open with that? Blah, blah, blah. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
That was like, I had a very nice beginning.
Yeah.
If there ever was a tough time, I'd say the beginning of my second season. I just remember feeling like...
And then what, that leveled off and you did 2 more years and you started to do on-camera stuff and what?
Yeah, that leveled off. That also, I don't know why I blew that out of proportion. That was like, you know, a few shows of feeling like...
Do you feel like you know Lauren and you're close to him?
Close, I don't know, but I've gotten to know him pretty well.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how close. You know, he's been... I've talked to him a lot in the past couple of years, I feel like.
Right.
And
with the TV show.
The TV show that he, you know, is producing.
Well, let's focus on that for a second. Because, like, so it seemed to me, like, before you did the TV show, that the buzz was, you know, you're going to be the update guy. You were the heir apparent.
There are no heirs apparent in show business.
Fine. You know what I'm saying. That
I understand, you know, what you're saying, but having...
But that was the word on the street. Was that not the word that you got?
I did some update features.
Right.
I entertained the idea that I might get it, but word on the street versus what you hear at a place like that is different.
But what was Lauren saying to you during that time? I mean, you weren't going to get fired from SNL. You were writing. You were starting to do stuff on camera. You were developing a relationship with that guy. What was he telling you? What was he teaching you? What did you think was going to happen for you?
I knew I was developing a lot as a writer, and I was made a producer on the show, and I knew I was doing very well there. I honestly, that like, I did not know where I stood in terms of that.
Performing.
Uh-huh. Which is a very common thing there. Like, as I said, it was very, very friendly. There was also still things that are cryptic and strange.
Did you want to do Update?
Sure, of course.
And was it ever offered to you?
It was not offered, and it was not offered, like, do you want to do it right now?
Right.
I think it was maybe a possibility.
Right.
But I then did a special that you, that what you saw in Montreal, then I recorded that in August or something.
For Comedy Central?
For Comedy Central. That special came out and I was a writer there, and the special was, you know, it was small, well reception, but it got a nice reception. So I was kind of like, I think maybe I'll move on.
That's interesting. You and Hannibal.
With yeah, Hannibal went to 30 Rock and then was gone.
But the decision was, I'm going to do stand-up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I've had enough of this writing for SNL thing.
I miss it still, but yeah, I was ready to go.
So you told Lauren you're leaving.
Yeah, well, let me think. I told him I was leaving, but I wanted to create a show.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of like, I'd like to continue working together, you know.
Oh, so you asked him to produce your show?
Yeah.
You said,
I mean, you, when you work for NBC and Broadway Video, it's not, I don't know if it is mandatory. No, it's not. My point is, there's a sort of natural thing to talk to them first about
developing. So he wanted to know, what are you going to do? What do you want to do?
Yeah, it was like all one meeting of, I'd like to develop this show and I don't think I'm coming back.
And he said what?
In that meeting, I think he thought I should take some time to think about it.
Right.
Which was true. But he was also really liked the idea of doing a show. I think maybe we talked about, would I be able to do both?
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I can't do that.
And what was the last show? So 30 Rock was his show as well, right? He didn't.
Yeah, at that time he was doing 30 Rock and Up All Night. So it seemed like all a natural, you know, I was like, oh, okay, well, this works out well, I thought.
Yeah.
You know? So my last show was Mick Jagger was the host.
Did you talk to Mick?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with him, actually.
You did?
Yes, because I would write a lot of the monologues.
Yeah.
So I would hang with those people in their dressing room because that's the thing that people were the most hands-on about,
right?
Because the one moment that they're themselves.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time with Mick Jagger. I spent a lot of time with Elton John. It was just an interesting way to like shadow those people was to work on the monologue because you'd constantly have to go in their dressing room.
And what was your impression of Mick?
I really liked him.
Yeah.
But he was... Like,
was he nervous?
No. He is a famous person.
Yeah.
He looks famous. Even if he wasn't in the Rolling Stones, if you saw him on the street, you'd go, oh, can I pay money to look at you? He has like really, I just remember staring at his hair and going like, this guy is like 22.
Yeah.
And I know that's said about him. Like, oh, he still has the energy of a 20. But I was like, this is like a young person. And just like, you know, long eyes, long eyeballs, and the face. I was just like, this is a fascinating person. He was Mick Jagger, so he was very, he'd been Mick Jagger for his whole life, so he was very famous.
Yeah.
He was like, those people that have played arenas just have a different outlook.
Yeah.
I don't mean or they're not diva-ish, but I think there's just like, he never had that thing of like, just being anything but Mick Jagger.
Right.
He would never be like, oh, does anyone have a laptop cord I could borrow?
Right.
You know? He was just very direct. I remember he would always be like, no, not funny. And like in comedy, you rarely hear not funny.
Yeah.
I mean, you do sometimes.
Right.
But
he had to say it. So he was saying,
he would go, no, I don't like that. Not funny. And like Elton John, and by the way, not mean, like you knew they were just like, what's the fastest way to make this conversation go?
Yeah.
Elton John would go, no, not doing it. No, are we done? Yes. Okay, I'll do that. Yes. Are we done? Good. Are we done? Good.
Uh-huh.
It was very like, I tour. I have things to do. Yeah. I'm Elton John. I've been Elton John for 30 years.
Yeah.
Are we done?
Yeah.
You know? So, I wrote a song with Mick Jagger. There was a sketch with a song in it. I was helping him write lyrics.
Yeah.
And it was just me and him sitting in his dressing room. And
who was playing an instrument?
No one. We were just writing lyrics.
Okay.
And he said, all right, what rhymes with drink? And there was a long pause. And I said, brink? And he went, no. And then there was another long pause. And I went, sink? And he went, yeah. And I was like, motherfucker, is this how you write songs? It was great.
So that's fun. So you got to hang out with a lot of those people who were hosting?
Sure. They have no idea that they ever were in a room with me. But yes, I got
just building
these
the
weird hours of sitting with these people.
Who were some other ones that left an impression on you?
I loved Danny DeVito.
Uh-huh.
He was amazing.
Well, he's a comedy guy.
Yeah, but he was doing a cameo in Charlie Day's monologue. Uh-huh. We just spent a lot of time working on it.
Uh-huh.
Because I was a huge fan of his, so I would stretch out the time as much as possible. And we would just write pages and pages of stuff that was unusable.
For a cameo?
Yeah, for a cameo. Just like long, so many rewrites. And I go, I'll put this on cards. And then that would jam up cue cards for like an hour. And then we'd do, like, most of it wouldn't work. We just had a fun couple days. And then my favorite thing about him was he met my then girlfriend uh-huh. at the after party. And he was she was a big fan of his from Always Sunny and many other things. But he was as excited to meet her as she was to meet him. I don't know why. He was like, hey, what do you do? She said, I'm a makeup artist and a hairstylist. He goes, I used to work in a hair salon. he was like just on it. It was great.
Sweet guy.
McCartney was very nice.
Yeah.
McCartney knew how to give everyone maybe 45 seconds uh-huh. of, I know how big of a deal this is to you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to listen to the thing you have to say to me. And I'm going to, and I'll take it in and I'll, and it was very interesting to see how he was like, I know how big of a deal this is to you. My mom came to a show he did and she, you know, would have rushed him if she could, but she, at the after party, she went by his table, but he had a couple bodyguards. It was a closed booth. My mom couldn't get in at that moment.
Yeah.
But she blew a kiss to him and he blew a kiss back.
Oh.
Yeah.
He's a classy guy.
Yeah.
Class act.
She said, he knows what that means to a woman of my age.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
He gets it.
Yeah.
Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney of the Beatles band.
Yeah. The famous Beatles. So who are the comics that you grew up loving?
The first comic I remember knowing or watching on TV was Dennis Wolfberg.
Sure. With the eyes.
Yeah.
And then the intensity.
He was from Chicago, but I watched him a lot on... you know, Comic Strip Live or whatever those shows were. And then, like, George Carlin stuff, but I must have been in, like, junior high then, and I was already sort of a comedy fanatic then.
Right.
So, like, yeah, but before that, just like, all the stand-ups of the 80s and 90s.
Right.
I just watched...
We had Comedy Central then. I mean, you grew up with Comedy Central, kind of, right?
Yeah, or was it just... There was a show, and it was not Evening at the Improv. It was called Comic Strip Live.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And it just, I watched that all the time.
Right. So you're a comedy fan.
I liked everyone, Amazing Jonathan. I just liked anyone I saw on TV.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I got into like albums in, you know, that same age when I got into like Monty Python and found out like what Caddyshack was.
Right.
Find out, you know, what like Led Zeppelin was.
Right. You started buying comedy records as well?
Yeah, started buying comedy albums and then liked, and then just I had tons of comedy albums, tons of like old radio show things. I liked everything.
So you're always gunning for it.
I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, all right. So Lauren agrees to develop this show.
Yeah.
And he secures a deal for you at NBC?
I think I maybe had already talked to NBC about doing something. Maybe they were aware of me.
But he was behind you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you get an agreement from NBC to develop a show.
Yes.
And you write the pilot.
Yes.
And you shoot the pilot.
We shot the pilot, yeah.
And they said, okay, let's do how many?
No, NBC passed on it.
Okay. So now Lauren's like, this is ridiculous.
He said, we'll take it to Fox.
It's so weird, though. NBC is his house. There was nothing, there was no conversation you were privy to that made you, because obviously he believed in the show.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But he didn't say, like, I can't believe they just didn't want this downstairs.
I'm trying to think. I mean, as successful as he's been, he's also had a lot of these.
Yeah.
You know, so he was, you know, immediately, I mean, full confidence that it would go.
Yeah.
Which I also, not knowing anything, had, you know, was confident that it would go. And then when it didn't go, it was kind of like, I just remember him saying, like, this is, you know, they don't know what they had and blah, blah, blah. And
made you feel better.
Totally, totally. Yeah. And also said, like, getting knocked down is really good for you, which it is.
Yeah.
So, but then it was immediately, like, Fox was interested in it.
Right.
So I feel like there was, like, a...
There was not much...
72-hour period of,
oh,
this
right.
is dead, and then it was like, oh, maybe we...
Were you panicking at all? I mean, did you feel...
No, I was just really, really sad, because I was never going to get to... I thought I'd never get to work with, like, Martin Short and Elliot Gould and just work on that stage again.
Right.
And just everything about it was like, oh, I wish I
loved it. You were like, this is what I
wanted. Loved it. I loved it. I wish I'd known that was going to be the last time where, you know, I had those
sure.
just really like, ugh.
So then Fox picks it up for what, six?
Six. We made six episodes last fall, and then we made seven episodes from the summer to like a month ago.
And now it's in trouble.
Well, yeah, but it was in trouble from the beginning.
Why?
Well, the ratings were low.
No, but what on your side, what do you think was the issue?
Oh, no. I don't think it was in trouble. When making it was a joy, mm-hmm. and it was actually a really incredible
experience.
It's a
show you wanted to make.
Absolutely.
100%. All the way through.
Do I go back and look at joke-to-joke things?
Yeah.
No, but I maybe think about changing a thing here or there.
Right.
But not the fundamentals, not the bones of it.
Right.
And, oh, yeah.
And you were there through all the writing.
Oh, yeah.
You get
it was my show.
Right, full script approval.
Absolutely. And it was very pleasant working with Fox. It wasn't like...
Right. Well, this
one of those crazy developments where they say, "Well, can you and Nassim Pedrad date each other and all that shit?"
Right, but I mean, and also you seem to have your head on your shoulders in terms of, to them it's show business. You know, to you it's your show, it's
right.
your life. But to them it's like, well, let's see what happens.
Right.
And
I think having been passed on at NBC, also I knew it could get taken away at any time.
But when you thought about like the kind of immediate comparisons to Seinfeld or to the structure of being a comic.
Right.
You know, I mean, did that bother you?
No, because I'd been working on... So then I developed this show starting in 2012 with NBC.
Right.
And I decided to be a comedian because I wanted to do stand-up on the show.
Right.
So I was aware that those comparisons were going to be made for like 2 years.
Right.
So when people started making them, I was only surprised by how many people made them.
Right.
Because I just was like, isn't that boring after a while?
To make the comparison.
Yeah.
It is what I do. So now where is the show?
The show's on Sunday nights.
Right.
It's still on. You said there was trouble. You meant like the problems?
No, I mean like, I think from an outsider's point of view, it looks like they're moving it around. And,
yeah,
and
it's a bumpy time right now.
It's a bumpy time.
Yeah, for sure. We got, we did not come out as a huge ratings hit right away.
Yeah.
And, I love the show. Some people do not.
Right. Yeah. And what do you think's going to happen?
I have no idea.
You really don't know?
Look, what happens to shows that have low ratings and don't take off as critical successes,
uh-huh.
they can get smoked.
Yeah.
And maybe that's going to happen.
Yeah.
But it's, I don't know. The one thing I've learned in all this is like, I have no fucking clue what's going to happen with these things.
And what if the worst happens? What are you going to do?
I'm on tour right now.
And how's your crowds? You pulling people?
It's been really fun. Yeah.
You're getting people. People are like, we want to see John Mulaney.
It's been good. Yeah. There's now that thing of like, oh, they came to see me.
Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, it's a good
feeling.
That's a really good feeling. I'm really actually, I love making the show. I'm really excited after a couple years of like working in a studio and an office to be back on the road.
Right. So it's fun to do stand up.
Yeah.
So,
and then if the worst happens, endless tour. Yeah.
Until you put another show together.
Yeah, but I loved this show. This was the show I wanted to make. I think it'd be a little while before I'd want to develop a thing again.
Are you scared? Are you sad?
Yeah, I'm a little scared.
Yeah.
And then I'm sort of like, I'm watching it all a little, I don't know why. If you told me, if you show me this on paper and we're like, hey, here's things people are going to say about your show and here's what the ratings are going to be and it's going to be a struggle. If you showed me that a year ago, I'd go, I'm going to be completely freaking out. I'm kind of watching it a little disassociated and it's kind of interesting.
Right.
Because it's like, how strange. Like, what an interesting thing to go through.
Oh, so you're in...
I'm sort of watching it...
You're in denial and you're stuffing your feelings.
No, I'm aware it's happening. I'm just not feeling it right now.
Right.
I'm sort of watching it like, well, that's interesting.
Now, does Lauren call you and say, don't worry about it. It's going to be...
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that.
Yeah, like, what does he say?
It's just very nice. I mean, like, it is scary. And he'll say, you know, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
And he said the good news is it's a good show.
Right.
And, like, you can, you know, the longer you're on the air, the longer you're on the air. I'm glad that Fox is airing all of these 13. I really hope people get invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
I have zero idea, though, if that will turn around or if we'll come back and it'll still be a struggle and we'll keep battling it out. I love making the show and I really love those people. So it's hard for me to be sad because I did it. You know, like, sure. I did it.
No, absolutely. I know.
But
I
I'm
know
scared,
that.
And I mean, and I'm like, oh, that's this is strange.
Well, it's interesting. Like your name's on it, right? It's called.
Yeah, when people say Mulaney sucks, that's me.
Yeah.
Or I hate Mulaney, or I hate John Mulaney, or things like that.
But I know, I also understand the other side of that, having done the show on IFC, it's not as big a profile, but there's this idea that when you do 10 of them or 12 or 13, there is part of you that's sort of like, well, I did it. I did it.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, like,
cause you go, well, I had, you know, maybe 16 stories to tell and
right,
I told
exactly.
13 of them and
yeah,
that's great.
It's good. It's out there and you know,
it's a bear. Making the damn things is mm-hmm. huge. So it was an incredible amount of work. It
I definitely get that. You know, it's a good position to have.
It's
you know,
a very
like,
good position.
Because like, you know, at IFC, I really didn't know what was going to happen. I don't even know what it's based on necessarily. So the idea was to make the best 10 shows I could and feel good about them all the way through.
Yeah.
Like knowing that you made your own decisions and you had creative control is not nothing.
No, and just being in charge and accepting that you're in charge and learning how to be in charge was invaluable enough.
Absolutely.
You know, and going like, oh, okay, this is a burden to be in charge, but there's also great, interesting freedom in it.
Right.
You know?
I like to pretend like I'm not in charge.
I did that for a while.
Yeah, it's good.
I go, who's going to figure that out? And then everyone was looking to me and I thought,
like,
oh,
but you guys are being paid.
Right.
But then you realize it's better if you figure it out.
Well, it's also I didn't realize that. I was like, surely I'll look to some adult in the room.
Now, what if Lauren said, let's say the worst that happens, they're like, okay, it's done. And Lauren says, you want to come back to SNL?
Come back to SNL?
Yeah.
Oh, as a writer?
Yeah, and maybe a performer.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if that would happen.
Oh. What if it did?
I mean, I'm in no position to turn down work, Mark. What are you talking about? Could I be on a show that's not going to be canceled? Ever? That everyone... Well, people criticize that too, but you know, you can roll with it because it's a variety show.
But you're okay and the comedy's going good. And your parents are happy?
I think they're happy, yeah.
With you?
Yeah. Yeah, we're good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I mean, it's like, why did I hesitate? It's just, you know, it's a funny question. Are your parents good with you? You know.
Yeah, well, it's scary when their kid goes into show business and then there's all this, you know, there's all this excitement.
You know, part of the thing was I was always trying to assure them how predictable it was, mm-hmm. or rather, I was trying to show them it was not unpredictable. I was like, Mom, it's very, very solid. Look at this.
It's like a doctor.
I've got an order of episodes from a major network called Fox, right? Yeah, it's, you know, I'm going to go in every day.
Right.
And I'm going to make this. And then suddenly it was like, Mom, I don't know they're going to take my show off the air. And I'm sorry, it's your last name too. And I don't know what I'm doing. I had a lot of that, autonomy. Suddenly, my mom, it's been fun. It's been fun because, like, if you have a Google alert, you can't. Things are going great, Mom.
Yeah,
like that era where you could go visit your parents and there was no internet, and you could go, "I'm a doctor and I'm married." And they're like, "Oh, we're so proud of you." Yeah. You know, like
and then you go back to your single bedroom.
Yeah, then
apartment.
You go back to your squat.
Yeah.
No, you can't do that.
She's got the Google alert.
She's got a Google alert. She knows what's up.
Oh, and she calling?
Your time slot moved. What does that mean?
Yeah. She calls you, are you okay?
Yeah. Well, yeah. One person was very mean. I know, Mom.
Yeah.
I turned the alert off 3 months ago. Yeah.
So this has brought you closer to your mother.
It's good to, it's been good to be knocked down to the ground, yeah. Because like I always thought I was a grounded person.
Yeah.
And then you get knocked down and you go, oh, that's where the ground is?
You got to write that down.
Okay.
It'll be on tape if you need it on this episode
of
WTF.
It is on tape, yeah.
Well, I hope that everything works out. I feel like you'll be all right.
I think it'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what, who cares? We're all going to pass away and die.
There's the John I'm looking for. There it is.
Look.
Yeah, existential,
I'll
man.
Do a series of these with you, and we'll get to the bottom of it.
Right.
Frost Nixon.
Well, let's call it a day then. I think we did all right.
I think we did great. It was nice to see you. Thanks
nice
for having
to see
me
you.
On
yeah.
this.
Yeah. So when do you think you're going to hear, though, about the destiny of your show? Could it be like any second?
I feel, well, it could be any second, right? But I also feel like, I just have this feeling it's not going to be any second. I feel like this moment in time will last for a long time.
Oof, it's hard.
But maybe it won't. Maybe we'll get, maybe my phone, when I take it off airport mode,
what's the best
there'll
thing,
be nine messages.
What's the best thing that can happen?
What's the best thing that can happen?
Yeah, like they say, like, all right, we're going to reconfigure it, or we're going to give it a better time slot, or what? I mean, what's the best thing?
The best thing that can happen with a TV show now is just time, more time. Because I actually don't care. The time slot thing's fine with me, because it's like, okay, well, was it hitting it out of the park at that time? No. So move it. Who cares? Everyone's watching it on Hulu or DVR anyway.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So it truly doesn't matter. It doesn't look good, but like, it's probably a good way to get some new people to see it.
Right.
To move it earlier in the night. So what's happening as of today is that it was moved to 7:30 from 9:30, just for posterity's sake. Yeah, on Sundays. So it doesn't fucking matter when a show's on.
Exactly.
People don't watch TV.
Great. Well, it was good talking to you.
It was great talking to you, man.
All right, buddy. John's a good kid. Good ending. He'll be all right. Whatever happens, that kid will be all right. That kid, listen to me. He's a grown man. Something comes out of me sometimes when I speak to the younger folks. Don't forget, folks, about The Frame, the new arts and culture news show produced by Southern California Public Radio and Vulture.com. Every day, The Frame covers the important stories in the arts and culture world, talking to the people who make the things you love. You can get it on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and at TheFrame.org. So go subscribe to The Frame. Dig it. Go to WTFpod.com. We're restocking shit for the holidays. I hope it wasn't too negative today at the beginning. It's just one of those days, man. I went on a hike. I guess I just got to breathe. I mean, here's the deal. A lot of stuff is going on. We're writing the show. Sometimes I don't always acknowledge, just how much is really going on, with me and my life. And, I think that as a way of, as a stress release kind of thing, or a stress relief, I just focus on the negative. That's the weird thing.
Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowerte-Dienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowerte-Dienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.